Blog Talk Radio.
With SRN News, I'm Bob Agnew in Washington. Hundreds of thousands of pro-lifers from all across the country are in Washington today for the annual March for Life. This marks the 42nd anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion in America. Among the pro-lifers turning out for today's gathering, Irina Browser, Family Research Council.
We have hundreds of thousands of people coming out, as they've had in the last 42 years, to support the babies who cannot defend themselves.
Browser says that she is encouraged by polls that show the youngest Americans these days are more pro-life.
It is very sad that 42 years later and 57 million babies dead later, we're still in March. But it is a testament to the fact that America will not stand for this.
Among the speakers sent to appear at today's pre-March rally, I should say, on the National March, are Republican Congressman Chris Smith from New Jersey, Republican Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, and Pastor Samuel Rodriguez, who heads up the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference. Also at SRNews.com, House Speaker John Boehner announcing he has invited the Israeli Prime Minister to address Congress next month.
I've invited the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, to address a joint session of Congress on the grave threats of radical Islam and the threat that Iran poses to not only the Middle East, but countries of the world.
That is House Speaker John Boehner, who says the invitation is meant to kill the president, if Congress will not stand idly by while he negotiates what critics say is a bad deal with Iran over its growing nuclear program. Netanyahu and Republicans have been sharply critical of those ongoing talks. Israel especially feels it's being threatened by Iran. Looking at the Wall Street, the Dow Jones Index collapsed, coming off a 30-point gain yesterday, opened up at 17,554, but could be at least a strong start this morning. The Dow futures up about 60 points. And this is SRN News.
It's the winter blues and warm up with hot flooring deals from Lumber Liquidators. Thinking about hardwood, consider bamboo. We've got the number one brand, and we'll help you get it for less. Like Strand Bamboo. It's twice as hard as oak, and for a limited time, it's only $1.99. Why pay as much as $4.99 for bamboo at other stores? We've got deals in over 70 styles for an incredible $179. Plus, pre-finished hardwood, laminate, and more for less than half what you'll pay somewhere else. And 18-month special financing. Now is the time to warm up your home with new floors. So visit LumberLiquidators.com to find a store near you.
As a retired teacher, I look for ways to save money for the things I love, like traveling the world. Medicare plans change each year. Fortunately, my HealthMark pharmacist helped me understand my insurance, saving me money on prescriptions. And it can help me too. My pharmacist cares about my health and the things I love, whatever that may be.
The Senate goes on record on the issue of climate change. Our friend Linda Kogan has reported.
The Senate has voted 97-1 in favor of an amendment to the Keystone XL pipeline bill that states climate change is real and is not a hoax. In a surprise move, Republican James Inhofe of Oklahoma, one of the most outspoken skeptics of climate change, voted yes. But Inhofe, who is also the chairman of the Senate Environment Committee, also made it clear that he does not believe humans are the primary contributors to climate change. The amendment was the only one out of six amendments to the Keystone bill that the Senate voted on Wednesday that passed. The Senate will continue to work on amendments to the bill on Thursday. Linda Kenyon, SRN News, Washington.
The only senator who voted against a climate change amendment was Republican Roger Wicker of Mississippi. As expected, the European Central Bank announcing it will inject a lot of money, up to 1 trillion euros, into the ailing eurozone economy. That good news bolstered Asian markets today in trading. This is SRN News. California public health officials have a warning and also some words of consolation for people who are going to Disneyland or would like to. They say the unvaccinated and children too young to be immunized against measles should avoid Disneyland right now after new infections of measles were linked to the theme park. Disneyland visitor Chris Jacobs says he's baffled by the outbreak.
I get really upset looking at it when I see it, you know, see the masks and stuff of all the outbreaks, because it's like it's easily preventable. We basically had it wiped out, and now it's coming back.
Janice LaRochelle says she and her family are not worried about catching measles at Disneyland, as she explained to KNBC-TV.
If we weren't vaccinated, it would be a different issue.
The latest cases are from an outbreak that began in late December and has sickened a total of 59 people in the state, 8 others in several other states, and Mexico have also fallen ill after visiting Disney parks in California. More details at SRNNews.com. From Washington, I'm Bob Agnew.
As a retired teacher, I look for ways to save money for the things I love, like traveling the world. Medicare plans change each year. Fortunately, my HealthSmart pharmacist helped me understand my insurance, saving me money on prescriptions. And they can help you, too. My pharmacist cares about my health and the things I love, whatever that might be.
HealthSmart, caring for you and about you. Visit HealthSmart.com for the locally owned pharmacy near you.
Did you donate anything to charity last year? Or did you tell your girlfriend you had donated something to charity, but really you just moved it to the attic because that CD tower is part of who you are? And if Michelle doesn't understand that, well, maybe Michelle doesn't understand you. Or, well, no matter what you went through last year, answering questions like, did you donate anything, is much simpler. Intuit TurboTax. It's amazing what you're capable of.
The opinions expressed on the following sponsored program are strictly those of its participants and are not necessarily those of WWPR Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
Like politicians, but underneath they were thugs. And they spread malicious rumors, threatening to have me busted for drugs. They had nothing on me. Oh, man, I was really clean. But they were big-time operators on a music business scene.
Good morning, listeners. This is Terry Wonder flying solo today on WWPR 1490 AM. For those of you who are concerned about It's Your Gavel Blogspot, I'm having trouble patching in the Blogspot to the radio, so I don't know if we're airing on the Blogspot or not. Mitch Mallett, wherever you are, I hope you're having a great cruise, and we'll see how this broadcast goes today. Anyway, we have a lot to talk about in this hour, and we're going to start with a follow-up to the State of the Union address on Tuesday night, talk a little bit about that. And then we're going to move on to some international matters, especially the French premier's announcement that they're going to take some exceptional measures against terrorism. And then we're going to move on to state and local issues as well. So it was a big night the other night with the president's State of the Union address. And he discussed a lot of things: child care, universal community college, and Iran in the State of the Union address. He also discussed ISIS. For the first time in his presidency, President Barack Obama addressed a majority Republican in both chambers. And he said that in a couple of weeks he would be sending a very practical budget to the Republican majority for debate. So we'll see how that goes. We're either going to go bipartisan or we're not. And the onus is upon the Democrats and the Republicans both to come up with something that will help our middle class, which all the research from our Nobel Prize-winning economists and others, Elizabeth Warren, for example, is saying that middle class is shrinking. So the majority of the speech was primarily about protecting the middle class and making sure that our next generations have a shot at the American dream. One of the major issues that he discussed was child care assistance, and he said that that's a national economic priority for all Americans. Said he had plans to make it more available and more affordable for middle-class and low-income families with children. And he also wants to expand community college, said that the fast-increasing numbers of employers require college experience for jobs, and this is happening in a country where too many bright, striving Americans are priced out of the education that they need. So he wants to make community college free for students that keep consistent high grades and graduate on time, and he wants to allow people in student loan debt to reduce their monthly payments. This sounds to me like Elizabeth Warren in the background here. If you, anyone who's following Elizabeth Warren, is a fan of Elizabeth Warren, knows that these are things that are very, very much a part of her senator's platform. And when she's on Bill Maher and is interviewed in other places, when she makes speeches around the country, these are the issues that she talks about. So I'm intrigued. And I'm feeling optimistic, and I do believe, despite the criticism, that there is an opportunity for Republicans to get involved with this. We've already seen from two of the presidential contenders from the Republican Party in 2016, Jeb Bush, and now Mitt Romney is also making some pronouncements about running again, and they're both talking about the middle class and what they can do for the middle class. So let's see where this goes. It's going to be an interesting couple of months. And they're going to meet privately today, Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney. Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney are scheduled to meet in Utah, raising the possibility that the two former governors will find a way to avoid competing presidential campaigns that would split the Republican establishment next year. And this is impressive. Maybe they'll run on the same ticket. It was Jeb Bush who proposed the meeting, according to one of the party members familiar with the planning. He didn't want to be quoted, but that's what he's saying. It's some kind of secret meeting they're going to have. And this is just incredible that he's reaching out this way.
Terry, I just have to jump in. I said I'd be silent, but this intrigues me so much. If Jeb and Mitt run together, who's going to be on top?
I don't know. we've had three Bushes. We've had two Bushes for president already. So I'm thinking Bush. It's going to be a Bush on top and a Romney on the bottom. No pun intended, sort of.
You know, Marco Rubio jumped in on this.
What did he say?
He said that, of course, if the Romney, Bush, all the other Republican governors are saying they have administrative experience, they know how to run things, and so Marco Rubio is touting his foreign policy experience. He says, well, that's what I'd say if I was a governor, but you really need someone that knows national security like I do with my half term of Senate seating. And Jeb Bush, I would think, being the son of a CIA director, president, ambassador to China, brother of Bush, he signed on for the project of a new American century with all the initial signers. So, and there's our reports that he ran the Iran-Contra operation out of Miami. So I don't know.
The Bushes, as a family, do have that collective experience, and they are connected, of course, and they are tied to oil wealth in other parts of the world. And so, I think you're right. The Bushes have foreign policy experience. I'm not so sure about Marco Rubio. I'm not confident about him when it comes to foreign policy. I don't feel confident about him at all in that respect. I think his experience is a bit limited for him to be making bold claims to that.
Right.
At this
who
point.
Would ever want to vote for a president who hadn't even finished his first term in the Senate?
That's a great question. I can't see it happening. I could see people voting for Jeb Bush. And a Bush versus a Hillary Clinton or an Elizabeth Warren or maybe a Leon Panetta. No one talks about Leon Panetta running, but he's former CIA director, too.
Defense secretary, too, wasn't he?
Yes, and defense secretary, and he had that long run in Congress.
Which was he when you were in Iraq?
He would have been defense secretary.
And how did people talk of him when your peers? You were of course a civilian employee of the Defense Department, but you served with military people. So how did they think of him, or did they talk?
My interactions with senior commanders, whom I won't name, were very. They felt very confident about him, And they were confident about Biden. A couple of times when I was stationed in Baghdad, Biden came in for a visit, and there was great confidence there. So Biden could run. I mean, there are so many options. It's going to be an interesting 2016. I think that Leon,
was there great confidence in Obama?
No one ever expressed things one way or another about the commander in chief. Military are very polite. They serve him, and I never heard criticism about him one way or another by senior commanders. So that's just the honest truth.
You can't say anything good.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, I voted for Obama, and except that a couple of times when I voted for Obama, evidently my absentee ballot votes didn't make it back here to Manatee County to get recorded. So I don't know what that was all about. But a lot of other people who were overseas or in training somewhere else who voted for anyone didn't get their ballots recorded. But nevertheless, I did vote for him.
Isn't it possible they don't bother to count those if it doesn't going to make a difference in the totals?
Yeah. So who knows what happened? We will never know what happened to my vote and the votes of so many other people in those elections who voted from overseas. I don't know. And in a very close race, it would have mattered in a very close race. So anyway, when I was in Iraq, and I was making, helping senior commanders, advising them about cultural matters, I really predicted where we would be today regarding ISIS. And what I told senior commanders when I was conducting my research in Baghdad between 2009 and 2010 was that there would be a second wave of some kind of al-Qaeda-based insurgency. And, of course, by that time, al-Qaeda of Iraq had changed its name to Islamic State of Iraq. And that was under the second leader after we had assassinated the previous leader, Mousab al-Zarqawi. The new leader of Islamic State is someone who goes by the name Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, and he has a PhD in Islamic studies from Baghdad. He's no idiot. He is not an idiot. The idea that these are just these crazy people who have no strategic plan, no capability for operational planning, no ability to tactically plan, they're just these ragtag people that go around making a mess of things, is not true. We've always known what his goals were. And his goals are not just about Iraq. They were always about expansion, because he is what I call a transformational guerrilla. These are not people that just get caught up in the contagion of warfare. They really are serious, and they are action-oriented people. They are not ones to rest. They are always about expansion, expansion, expansion. So when the Arab Spring broke out and the fighting in Syria broke out, this mercenary army that had all this live fire training in Iraq, where do you think they went? They went to Syria, and now they're back in Iraq for that second wave that I had predicted in 2009 and 2010. And this has implications for future planning. Because if you know that it's statistically inevitable that there will be a second wave of insurgency, suffice it to say you should be planning for future operations and doing some war gaming, as the military calls it, and also communicating with Department of State and the highest levels of office. And it's intriguing to me that we are only now reaching that point. I'm happy about the president.
Let me ask you a question about it before you leave it. Now, I had seen reports that Baghdadi had been imprisoned in Iraq by us and the Iraqi government, but then he was rehabbed back to the so-called Syrian moderates to go up against Assad, that he was sort of a tool of ours for that. Was that true?
I don't know. And, you know, the way the CIA has operated over the years, over the decades, it wouldn't surprise me if something like that had happened. But I don't know. I can't speak to that. And even if I did know, I wouldn't be allowed to say so anyway. Yeah, we have a caller on the line. So let's see who that is. Hello, this is Terry Wonder on WWPR 1490 AM. What's your pleasure today?
Good morning, Terry. This is Lawrence of St. Petersburg in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Good morning, Lawrence. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
What's your pleasure to talk about? What gavel would you like to bang today, Lawrence?
Yeah. Oh, that's the other show. I was just wanting to comment on you saying that the military doesn't have much negative to say about President Obama in your experience and with your resume. Isn't that correct?
Well, yes, that's military is geared toward that. And, you know, when we're working downrange, you know, there are people working 15, 20-hour days every day for long periods of time, months at a time, and we're mission-focused. So we don't sit around and, you know, complain about the commander-in-chief, even if we have complaints about him and what he might be doing, what he might not be doing. Our mission, we're mission-focused people, so we're focused on our current operation and planning for future operations.
So you're saying that they don't talk about the commander-in-chief when they're on duty. That's what you're saying now. Is that correct?
Yes. And you're on duty all the time when you're in Iraq in a battle zone.
Okay, because I fortunately and have had the great pleasure for over 10 years to have a close relationship with a significant number of military personnel that are still currently in the military. And they touch in the areas that you were speaking of, and it's contrary to your opinion. And I just wanted to point that out to you, that I contend that the large majority of the people that I have associated with that are currently in the military and have been career for over or 20 years have a low opinion of the commander-in-chief at this particular time, and that is more factual and in reality. What say to you, Terry?
Well, thank you, Lawrence. I shall talk about this. I don't know who these people are that Lawrence communicates with, but the military is full of all kinds of people. Some of them are Democrats. Some of them are Republicans. Some of them are independents. The military is a microcosm of the citizens of the United States of America, and in their own time, they are probably going to have opinions one way or another about whatever commander-in-chief is running.
I'm sure whoever shared their confidences with Lawrence are thrilled that he shares them on the radio with all of your listeners.
Yeah, that's kind of intriguing. Thank you, Henry. And Henry, thank you for coming in today and saving my you-know-what.
I think you're
really
doing fine.
I appreciate it.
I just pressed a couple buttons here.
I really, really appreciate this. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your presence here today, because I don't think we would have had a show had Henry not walked in. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, so Islamic State is Islamic State.
I really don't think I'm the more resourceful one in the studio today,
yeah,
so don't sell yourself short.
I'll share a story about something that happened after my last deployment. I was invited to be a participant in a roundtable discussion at with a group of people up in the Beltway area, and it was about future threats. And this was still when we had combat troops in Iraq, but we weren't getting outside the wire anymore. It was during the drawdown. So this would have been the middle of 2010. And I went up to another city in Virginia to participate in this unclassified conference. And I was there with someone from the Institute for the Study of War and another person who was a retired colonel, and then there was little old me. And the other people were just banging the drum about how the next threat to Iraq and the stability of Iraq would be the Republic of Iran. That's what was going to make a mess of things operationally in Iraq during a second wave of insurgency. That's what they were maintaining.
Who were these people?
One of them was a retired colonel. I don't even remember his name.
Okay.
And the other person was a representative from a group called the Institute for the Study of War. And frankly, you can go on the Institute for the Study of War's website. They actually do really, really excellent geospatial analysis and other kinds of analysis. But I was the dissenter on the panel, and I said no. I said the next wave of violence in Iraq that will threaten to topple the government of Baghdad will be a second wave of the insurgency that we just put down. It's going to be Islamic State again. Remember, when I say Islamic State, I'm serious. Islamic State named itself that after the death of the first leader who called the group Al-Qaeda of Iraq.
Maybe you should explain to the audience that is just tuning in for the first time why, besides just geographically being there, you have that kind of insight.
Well, because I'm an expert in this. I follow the history of this group. And
you were on the ground talking to the common people.
Yes, I was.
And beyond common.
Oh, yes. On my first deployment, I did really serious ethnographic research to assist military operation in the stabilization of these areas in the northwestern and western areas of Iraq where Al-Qaeda of Iraq under Musab al-Zarqawi had pretty much taken over. And it was our main mission during the surge of 2007 to put that dominant wave of insurgency down, because it was Al-Qaeda that was threatening to topple the government of Baghdad at that time. And if you study the history of insurgencies, one thing you know is that no matter when you have an insurgency that is absolutely capable of bringing down a central government, if that government and other multinational security forces are capable of putting that first wave of insurgency down, they should get prepared for a second wave. It is statistically inevitable. And so that is indeed where we are. And I've got to say, people like to pick on the Sunni Arabs in those places where I worked. They say, oh, they're just siding with Islamic State. That's not true. That is not true. By the time when I was out interviewing people, finding out what had happened to them from 2003 and afterward, they said amazing. They said, we're worried about what's going to happen after you leave, because we know that they will come back. We know. And these communities had been weakened. They had had their social structure obliterated during the violence, during that first outbreak of warfare. And all warring parties over there were responsible for that violence and that disruption of their social structure. So in the absence of being able to fully strengthen those communities, to put them back together again before the second wave of insurgency, you are asking for a group like Islamic State to come back in and take over those areas. And that is precisely what happened, and that is what I predicted when I was over there. I'll tell you what, we need to give some call-in numbers, and then we're going to take a break. If you would like to call in to WWPR 1490 AM, and again, I apologize, we were just not able to get It's Your Gavel connected, and I don't know what happened there. So we don't have a It's Your Gavel phone number to give you. So the only number you're going to be able to reach us on today is 941 941-745-1490. That's our call-in number for the day, 941-745-1490. We're going to take a commercial break.
Do you know who's awesome? You. You might not know this yet, but you can help make a difference, all by joining the San Diego Zoo Global Wildlife Conservancy. They are an organization dedicated to helping endangered animals, and you can help right now. You can literally save the lives of endangered animals all over the world. Endangered animals are waiting for your help, but not for long, so don't keep them waiting. Help make the difference and join the San Diego Zoo Global Wildlife Conservancy.
To join, visit endextinction.org.
How was your day? What did you do in school? I'm Andy Ford, president of the Florida Education Association, and these two simple questions can encourage learning in your home. Showing interest and asking about the school day can help motivate your child and keep them excited about learning. So stay involved, stay curious, and ask specific questions. Student success involves the whole family. Be sure to take the opportunity during daily conversations to talk with your child about what they're learning. Help set academic goals and discuss a plan of action to meet those goals. Whether it's improving on weekly spelling tests or allowing enough time to eat breakfast every day before school, every small step taken helps build momentum to academic success. Working together, parents and teachers in Florida can make this a great school year for every student.
A message from the Florida Education Association.
Okay, good morning, listeners. This is Terry Wonder, flying solo, and I have here with me Henry Raines from the Morning Edge. So here we are back on the air, 1490 AM, WWPR, and another one of the announcements this week comes from the French Premier Emmanuel Valls on the exceptional measures to fight terrorism. He wants to create thousands of new counterterrorism jobs to intensify the monitoring of nearly 3,000 people that the French police consider surveillance targets. Remember that the attackers a few weeks ago had been under watch, but then they fell through the cracks. Something happened. We don't know what. One of the things that the French premier had discussed when he made this announcement was the radicalization that takes place in some of these Muslim communities in France. And I would like to speak to that because there, in all Muslim communities around the world, you have people who are called imams, who are the leaders of local mosques, and some of these imams are called by the French scholar Gilles Kepel political imams. And these types of imams do not have years and years of education from Islamic universities in which they might learn some form of Islam that rejects terrorism. And or just this what we call jihadism, where people say the doctrine is that people that it is the duty of all Muslims to wage war on others who attack Muslims and also to conquer territory that may have never even been Islamic territory in the past. So. These political imams, what they do, and from my research, is they will seek out what I would call a weak mosque. This is a mosque that maybe some other immigrants from a previous generation of immigration in the country had established, but perhaps they were having trouble raising money, building the mosque. So it's a weak mosque. And what will happen is a new wave of immigrants will come into that area, and they will take over the mosque, either through a boardroom coup, or sometimes it actually happens through violence. And these political
mosques... What do you mean by that?
Well, they might actually physically attack the existing imam or leader of the mosque and its board members and drive them out.
Right here in the U.S.?
It has happened here in the United States of America, yes. In fact, it has happened right here in the Tampa Bay area. This is a very little-known fact.
Come on, you got to give us the example?
Yeah, I'm going to give you the example. I wrote about this in my doctoral thesis. This happened in the Tampa Bay area in Temple Terrace back in 1986. And it was someone who was regarded as a civil rights hero who did this, Sammy Al-Arian and his brother Mazen Al-Najjar. And Sammy... There was another professor at USF. He was an adjunct professor of mathematics who was the imam of the mosque in 1986 it had no name. And honestly,
the mosque with no name.
Yeah,
sounds like a song.
it does. Like a horse with no name. Only this was a mosque that had yet to acquire a name.
Been to the desert to a mosque with no name. It makes perfect sense.
It does make total sense. So Sammy and his brother had become involved with this mosque. They had another agenda. They took over the mosque. The wife of the mathematics professor who was the original imam of that mosque was struck in the gut. She was pregnant. She was struck by another woman with a large purse. The sheriffs were called to the scene. But back in 1996, no one really understood anything, and they just thought it was this dispute over who controls the mosque. And so there was never any dispute. But the mathematics professor was driven out of the mosque. His wife was driven out of the mosque, and the original congregants were driven out of the mosque. And this math professor left the university. He was scared for his life. He left. And this is a little-known fact about the history of what became the Izz al-Din al-Qassim Mosque under Sammy al-Arian.
Let me try to get this straight. The original imam, who was also a professor at USF,
mm-hmm.
his wife was attacked.
Yes.
And she was pregnant?
She was pregnant.
Did she miscarry?
No.
But she got the message. They both got the message.
Yes, they did. Both got the message.
And what happened? Were there the original congregants?
They left. They had two entirely different ways of knowing Islam. And so Sammy al-Arian...
Did you find the alternative mosque that these people went to?
They left town. The imam and his wife left.
What about the congregants?
They may have stayed in the area. I don't know what happened to them. But they were driven out. And this is something that happens in communities all over the world. And when I found out about this at USF, I was amazed because I had been a study abroad student at the American University at Cairo in Egypt in 1998. And I had toured the Nile. And at one point, and this was just after the 1997 attacks on the Western Taurus at the Temple of Luxor, farther upriver, which would be south in Egypt, upriver. And so I had gone to the Temple at Luxor, and I had met some...
In Dixie, we call it down south.
Yeah. it's down south. And so anyway, I met some of the security guards at that temple who had been injured in those attacks. And they just wanted to talk to me. And what's fascinating is usually Muslim males and Arab males are very, very reserved around me. But I found this one security guard who was just totally animated. All he wanted to do was talk. And he kept saying to me, this was in 1997, he said to me, they take over the mosques. They take over the mosques. They take over the mosques. They, meaning the political imams who work for the Egyptian Islamic Jihad, which was what had waged all those attacks in Egypt and had destroyed Egypt's economy by that point. And the leader of the EIJ was Ayman al-Zarqawi, who is now the leader of al-Qaeda.
EIJ?
Yeah, EIJ. Egyptian Islamic Jihad.
Okay.
And so they plant political imams in these mosques. They take over these otherwise benign mosques that don't practice holy war. And the new political imams have a doctrine of holy war. They're very purist in their religious outlook. And they find scriptural justification for their actions and for their nationalist in the case of Sami al-Arian, or ultra nationalist as in the case of Al Qaeda and Islamic State for their causes. So that's what they do, and this is a phenomenon that happens all over the world. Come to find out, in the early 2000s, we had an incident at the Red Mosque in Pakistan, another coup, a mosque coup. It happens rather. It's more common than you think. I would suspect it's happening in Africa. If you were to start going around doing sociological research in Nigeria and other places, I would suspect that you would find similar activities taking place in these weak mosques. And sometimes it's just it's a different generation of immigrants. You have the earlier generations of immigrants aren't into holy war. They tend to have left their country because they're tired of all of that. But sometimes you get these newer generations that come in and they fall sway to these very persuasive political imams. It's just a phenomenon that happens.
Now, Samuel Arian, he was held in indefinite detention for a long time. Wasn't it based on secret evidence?
No, he was not held in indefinite detention. Eventually, he pled no contest to lying.
Well, up until that point.
He was served an indictment and arrested, and then he went on trial, and then there was a mistrial, but then he pled no contest to certain things, so he was under house arrest, and he's been released more recently.
But he was a cause célèbre for the way he was treated.
Yes, he was.
In the conditions in the prison.
Well, that was his brother-in-law, Mazen al-Najjar, actually.
That's the one that left, though. But I know Sami al-Arian was kept right up in
around
Orlando or so.
He was kept
in solitary confinement.
No, not in Orlando. It was the Coleman the Coleman facility.
Central Florida.
Yeah.
Oh, Orlando.
Up by 75. He was kept there, but that was while he was awaiting trial.
Yeah, but he was...
He went on a hunger strike.
Yeah, well, years ago,
and he had diabetes.
We interviewed his attorney, and when he would meet with his attorney, they would force him to have his hands tied, handcuffed behind his back, and he would have to bend over, carry his paperwork on his back in a 90-degree angle. They wouldn't help him carry it, and they wouldn't allow him to hold it in front of himself.
Yeah, he
and the strips and even though the attorney was in a separate room, he was still strip searched every time he met with his attorney.
Yes.
So he could be a bad. You can have two ideas in the same thought. And one is he could be a bad guy, but he could also be one of the earliest victims of the.
Mistreatment
kind
of prisoners.
Yeah.
And I agree with that. Prisoners.
Now,
in any circumstance. We learned the hard way in Iraq that was just the wrong way to do things.
Now, I understand when you look at some of the mosques in the U.S., even the moderate ones, that they still get a lot of funding from Saudi Arabia.
Yes. But that's not to say that every mosque who receives funding from Saudi Arabia is full of bad guys and girls. Are they required somehow to use literature from that's published through Saudi Arabian institutions? Yes. Are they more conservative in their outlook in terms of the way women at the mosque are expected to dress, yes, but that does not mean that there is a terrorist in every Saudi Arabian mosque. And
funded mosque.
Yeah, funded mosque. Yes, so it's you know, I try to be a little more nuanced about Saudi Arabia's.
Now, what about the controversy about the Cordova House up in New York City near the 9/11 incident? What about that community center?
I haven't followed that one quite assiduously. By that time, I was in high gear in Iraq and dealing with Iraq, so I really missed out on the details of the Cordova House. I know people
were
really
expect a report on Tuesday
that.
On the next Hit Your Gavel.
Okay. All right, yes. What else do we want to talk about? I'd like to switch gears.
Okay.
I would like to talk about two bills in the state of Florida that are making their way through all the usual channels. And one is Senate Bill 166, and it has a corresponding House Bill 169, and these are about hydraulic fracturing. For those of you who don't know what hydraulic fracturing is, you may know it by its other name, fracking. And this is a process of pumping fluid into or under the ground to create rock fractures to produce or recover oil or gas. And it involves the use of chemicals, some of which are highly harmful to health and the environment. So these bills address a strong public safety risk to the people of Florida and our aquifer. So we've already had problems in Florida and other places around the world with fracturing. In some states, they are known to cause earthquakes, such as in Oklahoma. They crack the rock and create new fractures that allow for saltwater intrusion into upper layers of rock. There are byproducts of hydraulic fracturing that we have to address too, which is what do you do with all the chemicals? What do you do with all the chemicals that are created following this process? They have to be stored somewhere. And, of course, here in Manatee County, it's quite possible that we might have a deep injection well in the future that would be responsible for storing those chemicals. So these are two Senate bills that have come up. They're being sponsored by Senator Darren Sota of Kissimmee and Senator Dwight Bullard of Cutter Bay, which is down there in the South Florida area. It's acid that's used in this process. So we're pumping acid into the ground in order to get oil or natural gas.
Is there anything special in the state of Florida as far as its substructure that would make this a problem?
Oh, my God, yes. We're all living on limestone, which is porous and soft, and clay, which... You know, it's not granite, people, that we're living on. If you come here from another place, you probably know what's below your feet as being something really hard like granite. Not here in Florida. We're living on limestone and clay. And these processes, in my humble opinion, don't belong in a state where everyone is living on lime rock and clay. There are just too many opportunities for things to go wrong. And without a water supply, with a water supply that's been annihilated by acid and all kinds of other byproducts from this process, I just don't think that's something we want in our neck of the woods. We have somebody on the line today. Her name is Debbie Glow. She's an animal welfare activist here in Manatee County. Debbie, what's your pleasure?
What's my pleasure? Good morning, Ms. Wonder. How are you doing today?
I'm well today. What's new in the world of the animal welfare movement of the county?
Okay. Well, I wanted to reach out to everybody and give a shout-out and remind them about the protests that we're having on this Saturday, January 24th, in front of the Beach Veterinarian Clinic. The address is 4404 124th Street Court in Bradenton. And if everybody would bring a sign, what we're protesting is, well, the Beach Vet is the vet for the county, actually Dr. Luke Berglund. And what we're protesting is, this protest is to honor all the animals condemned to death by the Beach Vet. Some lived and many have died. And this has been going on and on and on. I've been in this for 4 years, and this has been going on and on and on. And we've got a bunch of public record requests that show many of these animals have been put down and not per the no-kill equation that we were promised back in 2011 by the BOCC. So I really would like to give a shout-out. We need as many people out there tomorrow. We need to stress to the people that live here, because I've run into so many of them in the last week or two, that Manatee County is not no-kill. So if your dog or cat gets picked up, you've got a good chance of losing your animal. Second, these animals are being put down for against the no-kill matrix, and the only animals that should be put down, we do realize animals need to be put down. The only animals that need to be put down are the ones that are severely suffering, say like an animal that got hit by a car, the back is broken, it's mangled, there's no chance of that animal surviving. An animal that has terminal cancer, say stage 4, and it maybe has a week to live and it's suffering horribly, or a dog that's so aggressive it can't be rehabilitated. We're not the crazies that think, oh, we're going to save every dog in the world. We realize you can't save every animal. And also, there was just couple more things I wanted to touch on if I got time, Terry, do I?
Yeah. Well, give me another minute.
Okay, give me another minute. We've had a lot of infighting in our groups. We've got like two groups out there that I would say that we really need to put our heads together and figure out how to force Manatee County to go no-kill. We've got the people out there that are great at networking animals, especially one site called SOSA. And we've got the people that, like me, that sit here and work behind the scenes, get the PRRs, and make sure that what we're putting out are facts.
So what's the infighting all about?
Okay, how can I explain this? It's gotten so bad, the name-calling has gotten horrible. I mean, it's just horrible. They want us to, there's many of us that have had problems with the shelter, and it's been going on for years. And the shelter now is bad-mouthing one of our big sites, which is called Support No Kill Manatee County, which is not associated with the county. But we call them the cheerleaders. They want us to all come in there, work with the dogs, do this, do that, and work with the adoption events.
Are they claiming that you're being responsible for causing animals harm?
Yes.
Is there any truth to that?
Yes, there is. We've received many, many letters that many emails that have been sent out from Mr. Hutchinson, who's the interim director of Manatee County.
What does he say about you?
Well, he says that, especially me, I'm a fictional writer when I write him an email.
Even though you're operating off of open records request and actual evidence?
Yes, we request the open PRRs, and we get them in, and we actually scan them, put them in our computers, and show everybody what is going on.
So why does he want to shut you up?
Why does he want to shut us up? Because I think he and Mr. Hunsinger have some plans. I feel, and it is rumored that he and Mr. Hunsinger have some plans to privatize the shelter.
The whole shelter, including the enforcement arm of it?
I'm not too sure about the enforcement part of it.
But pet adoption.
The pet adoption mainly. So in my mind, and I'm saying this in my own opinion, they would have a really nice facility, say like over in Lakewood Ranch, that they would take all the animals to, and that facility would keep all the little fluffy puppies and the nice little dogs and the ones that are adoptable in their sight. And the ones that aren't adoptable, like the pitties and stuff like that, would go back over to Manatee County and be euthanized.
Yeah.
So the transparency is totally gone.
So Ed Hunsaker is the county administrator for Manatee.
Yes.
And Animal Services is one of our agencies that he's responsible for. He's responsible for all the employees there. And ultimately what happens in Animal Services happens on his watch. So he wants to privatize the pet adoption part of the shelter and essentially separate the things and let the shelter itself off the hook for the responsibility of the animals. Do you think that they're going to abolish no-kill over time?
I'm thinking that's the way it's headed.
Yeah, that's going to be it's going to be a really interesting year to see what happens when all is said and done.
I'm sorry, Terry. When you said abolish no kill and all the hype that's been in the paper and the controversy, I would think that they won't abolish no kill. They'll change the definition.
Well, they've already changed the way that you calculate the save rate for the animals. And it is not the same calculation that the No-Kill Advocacy Center uses. And the other thing that we found out when Debbie was on the air on Tuesday was that they monitor the website for Manatee County Animal Services through mymanatee.org or gov. And
I think it's org.
Yeah, I think it is an org. It's kind of strange. Anyway, so they monitor that website, and what they've found is that all of the information about no-kill and that has been on that website since 2011, all of that has been removed. So something is afoot.
Been removed too.
We don't know what it is that's afoot, but they've removed a lot of that information. And this comes as a result of all the criticism about the shelter not being no-kill. And it worries the animal welfare activists because people think that the shelter is a no-kill facility, so they want to give up their pet. They think they're taking their pet to a no-kill facility. And you got to read the fine print.
Well, I almost have some firsthand info on that. My daughter.
Do tell.
Is Debbie still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, maybe she'll have some insight. And we are just up against the clock here. My daughter picked up a stray, probably about a 10-year-old female, and she couldn't keep it, and so she took it to the animal services, and she was going to monitor it. She was checking every day to see. But they had told her it would be about a week until it was euthanized. And I was wondering, with not being outwardly sick, how they were able to tell her that when they dropped the dog off. I didn't think that would fit the policy.
It doesn't fit the no-kill policy, but what they do is if you bring a dog in as a stray, it is held in impound for 5 days, and then they determine if the dog's adoptable or not. But they should have never made that remark to her when first telling her the dog would be euthanized. Because you just can't look, admins at the front desk can't look at a dog and say, oh, the dog's going to be euthanized.
Well, to be generous, maybe they thought that they could pull some heartstrings and get the dog taken care of that way by her.
Did they network that? The other problem is, did they network the dog?
That's another criticism, that they don't try to network the dogs. You know, they receive a dog and they don't start, you know, phone calling all the plethora of rescue groups all over the place. I mean, they're all everywhere, these rescue groups. And that's one of the problems is that the shelter employees don't pick up the 500-pound telephone and start calling people and saying, hey, we've taken in another animal, this is what it is. In 5 days, you have a shot at it.
Well, as a devil's advocate, because my dog got picked up as a stray, and we kept monitoring the website. We got him before he ever spent a night in mm-hmm. prison. But, you know, why do I want my tax dollars spent adding employees to do that? It should be the owner's responsibility.
Well, what the no-kill advocates say is that actually there are counties very similar to Manatee in terms of population size that are capable of doing all these things, and that's because they restructure what their existing employees do. So it's an ongoing battle. And Debbie Debbie, your work is greatly appreciated. We are coming up on the end of the hour, so I would like to thank all of you who tuned in, and I'd like to apologize, too, for not being able to get It's Your Gavel on Blogspot going. We'll be back on the air with that part of the program next week. This is Terry Wonder with Henry Raines, WWPR 1490 AM.
WWPR, Bradenton, Sarasota, Tampa Bay.
Religious and political leaders will address the crowd before pro-lifers march to the steps of the Supreme Court building. Republican Congressman Mike Pompeo of Kansas says the large youth contingent is evidence that the pro-life movement is stronger than ever.
That's White House correspondent Greg Cluxton. Emily Zinder of Illinois Right to Life is encouraged by polls that show the youngest Americans these days are more pro-life.
Every January is marked with sadness as we remember Roe v. Wade and all the lives that have been lost. But we can't help but to be incredibly hopeful because the faces of the youth tell us what's going to happen in the future.
Also at SRNews.com, senators continuing to work through amendments to the Keystone XL pipeline bill on Capitol Hill.
One of the amendments that has passed puts the Senate on record as saying climate change is real and is not a hoax. Environment and Public Works Committee Chairman Senator James Inhofe supported that amendment. This came as a surprise because Senator Inhofe is a leading climate change skeptic.